Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
I wish I could say that, oh, I've totally surrendered to putting my art on a back burner and just completely relishing and being a mom, but it would be a lie, you know? It wasn't until I had Mila that I realized that for me, making art is so much more than having a career. And I realized for me, it's my spiritual practice.
Today, I am delighted to share in conversation with Maya Rusnik. Maya is a painter and storyteller who conjures form and narrative from ground-up mineral, smeared oil, and stained canvas. She has an MFA from the California College of Arts, and her work has been exhibited internationally and written about extensively, most notably in Art Maze magazine, Juxtapose, San Francisco Bay Guardian, Studio Visit magazine, and twice in New American Paintings. Maya is represented by Conduit, Hales and Karma, and has an upcoming solo show at the Harwood Museum in Taos, New Mexico in March of 2021. Also, she recently had a baby just 7 weeks ago, and I am so honored and excited to welcome you, Maya, to the Artist Mother Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Kaylin, so much for taking the time to interview me, and it'll be my first time talking about what it's like to be an artist and a mother.
I can't wait. So let's have you start by just giving us, you know, a little bit of information about your background, something about your childhood that maybe got you interested in art, or something that you can point back to that kind of brought you on the path that led you to today.
I wasn't sort of that typical artist kid who sort of always knew that they wanted to be an artist. But I do remember an experience when I was around 8 years old. We were in Austria. My mom and I had fled there during the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I remember playing in the sandbox by myself while the other kids were sort of playing in the playground. And something about the warmth of the sand, it was a really beautiful summer day. I think it was June or July. I know the war started in April, so it was a couple of months after that. And I just remember feeling the sense of peace in the sand and the way that it felt on my legs. And I remember looking up at the sun and thinking, wow, there's something deeper that's beyond this world of the children out there in the playground laughing and screaming. Like, I remember my tiny little brain knew that, you know, it's sort of, I got access to what's on the other side of the veil when I was around 8 years old. And that moment, I keep coming back to a lot as an adult, as the sort of seed or a door that was opened to me by, I don't know, religious people, maybe would say God. I'd call myself more of a spiritual person, but something was showed itself to me. And I think the art for me is an attempt to always reach that place or see what else is over there on the other side of the veil.
That is so lovely and inspiring. Do you think part of it was just like awareness of yourself and your senses, like, you know, just picturing you running your hands through the sand, and but then also like that connection between something beyond you? Like, I think, you know, little kids, they are so aware of their bodies, but I think they're also just in motion so much, you know, that it's often hard for me to think of my kids as like extremely just calm and having these moments of reflection. Think of you as an eight-year-old kind of, you know, just being aware, like having awareness, is really lovely.
Yeah, like I wonder if, you know, it's sort of like, I guess what you're talking about is like a sense of introspection, right? And that come in. I've taught little kids a lot in California when we lived there. And so, yeah, I don't know if it was, you know, my personality or, but I have definitely always been told that I'm kind of a, quote, weird kid, you know? So like being alone, I remember other times just staring in the mirror and repeating my name until I would feel like I disappeared. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like by naming myself that the name made me kind of fall apart. And I remember it was almost like a chant. Like I would chant myself into some state by saying Maya, 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 Maya. Mm. And I would do that as a kid. So I don't know. I don't know if most kids do this.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like almost just a meditation like that.
Yeah. And nobody was meditating or chanting around me. So, yeah, I think I was always very sensorial. Like my senses were, always very like in hyper alert mode, which is both a good and a bad thing as an adult. You know, I feel super sensitive in all kinds of ways. At times I'm really feel fortunate that I have that ability to feel connected to everyone and everything around me. And in other times I feel overwhelmed by it, you know? Mm. So there, I think there's a sense of porousness that I love when I'm in the studio. And then at times it's just, too much, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think the art became maybe as a gift and a channel to do something with that sense of too muchness, you know, sense of being oversaturated by feeling and emotion and stimuli. The art became a way to sort of just channel it and sift through it.
I love that. I want to just dive right in and have you talk about your paintings. Could you share a little bit about what they look like and a bit about the process? You've already touched on it a little. It's just so beautiful to hear you talk about, you know, just your being and then having read some about your paintings and your process. I can tell they're so connected. Can you talk a little bit about what your work looks like and, you know, some of the materials you use?
Yeah. So the work I'll be talking about mainly is the work I'm making now. So my work hasn't really looked like this for too long, but then again, I'm not a very old artist. Mm-hmm. I consider myself quite young, even though I'm not very young in age. But this sort of work that's sort of diffused colors where the edges are sort of blurred and a lot of scumbling, I would say is about 2-3 years old. Or I've been doing it for 2 to 3 years. And the scumbling actually happened because when we lived in LA, we were quite broke, as most artists are, and struggling to make ends meet. And I remember I was working on a painting and I ran out of cadmium red and I just started diluting it to make it sort of stretch, like cutting milk with water or something. And the color started fading. So out of necessity, it became more pale and more kind of weathered looking, the painting. And so then that became an opening, sort of this problem became an opening. And I started diluting my paint from that point on. So that instead of adding white or other pale colors to really saturated colors, I just started adding a lot of medium. So like wax and oil. So the painting started looking more ethereal. I think that's what started happening with the more diffused color, more sort of dreamlike. They're almost always figures, but not all the time. I'd say for every 10 figurative paintings I make, there are maybe 2 or 3 that are fairly abstract in the sense that, you know, a person might not recognize a foot or a nose or something like that. Although I try to make the work not seem very illustrative in the sense where I don't want the quote, what is happening to sort of out right away. The painting sort of, I attempt to lure the viewer in a seductive way by color and texture and the surface of the canvas. And then maybe once you get up close or step back, you start noticing little things like, oh my gosh, is that a person? Mm-hmm. Is that a tree? I try to think of them almost as they reward the viewer the longer they stay. Mm. Now, if you just kind of quickly walk by it, you might just think of it as like it's like a blue purple painting, kind of a color field. But almost like if you start trying to remember something, and if you're in a room with people who were with you when that something happened, you start with the memory, and then they're like, oh, I remember, then this happened, and then this happened. I sort of want the painting to unravel in that way, mm-hmm. where a part unravels and it helps you decode what this other part is on the left corner. Sort of like the logic of it emerges with time very slowly. And, you know, I'm not a very slow person. You can ask my husband. He always calls me an athlete, like I move a million miles an hour. Mm. And it's just the way that I deal with my anxiety, which I suffer from. I have a lot of anxiety. So one way that I deal with it in life is by being very active, like by exercising and stretching and cleaning my studio and keeping things neat and orderly. But what I seek from art is the opposite.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
I feel the same, that I have this like control, like I am just somebody who wants to have things go the way I want them to go. And, you know, I find that what I'm seeking in my painting practice is like the lack of control and the freedom and the experimentation and, you know, just the enjoyment of the journey. So it's interesting to hear you have that similar, you know, the what you're looking for. Yeah. Within the work is something that maybe you feel you don't have or can't find without digging into the process.
Well, I wonder if it's because it's maybe when we're sort of managing life, you know, paying the bills and being on the phone with a person with our insurance card or whatever, it's very like monotonous and not very creative. Mm-hmm. So maybe once we get to the place where we're making art, it is, you don't want that sense of order again.
Mm-hmm.
You just an hour on the phone paying your bills.
Right.
Or so, yeah, I think there's something, I think when we're trying to enter a different space, you have to behave differently. Mm-hmm. So all control that we exude or that we try to put into life just doesn't seem to work. Or at least maybe it sounds like for your paintings too, which I've looked at and I can see. But for the way that I want the paintings to register with the viewer, there's nothing about me making them tighter that would do that. It would actually just take away.
Right. Mm. And I think too, you know, just back to that, I'm so glad you started with that moment of you as a kid in the sandbox, you know, because I think as painters and artists, you know, we're trying to like have those conditions ready so we can build that moment of, you know, introspection and like that sensual moment that we're longing for. It doesn't always happen, right? Because we get too in our head. But I think that's the magic of it, you know, that keeps us going back.
And I think sensual is the word,
yeah.
You know, where our senses are so open and you feel really, you know, at the risk of sounding cheesy, like the sense of connection with the cosmos and with everything around you. I think that's peace.
Yes.
And I long for that state of being.
Yes.
I know it when I'm in it, and it could happen when I'm making a painting or when I'm hiking, when I'm playing with my cat. So it doesn't have to be art making per se, but it's like you notice these sort of gifted moments when mm-hmm. they happen. You notice how rare they are and how different you feel when they're happening.
Mm-hmm. And what a gift to, you know, try to make a living doing something that brings so much pleasure.
It really is a gift. And I feel and recognize my privilege every day.
Yeah. Yeah. I read too that your palette really changed when you moved from California to New Mexico. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. Just because I didn't realize you lived in New Mexico until I was already familiar with your work. And then once I, you know, realized it, I was like, oh, I could see it. And I've looked through all the shows that you have on your website, and you can really see the evolution of, you know, sort of the desaturation and the earth tones kind of coming through. I was just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit and, you know, if you're liking the New Mexico landscape.
Yeah, well, I think colors are emotional for me, at least, you know, so like a hot pink, when you see it, it evokes an emotion that's very different than a super muted, weathered looking green, you know, like it puts me in a very different state of mind. So when we lived in LA, everything was bright. The color, the type of the sunlight there was really kind of scorching and bleached out and really intense. And it's hot where we are now. We're in the desert, but the colors around, like, they're not as many billboards. They're not as many fashion-y things. They're not a lot of literally like flashing lights. So I think I just started feeling more calm. When we moved here, I stopped spending a lot of time in the car. When we lived in LA, I worked about an hour and a half away when I taught to make a living. So I spent a lot of time in the car. Being in the car is very loud. LA traffic is crazy, you know, so the honking, the noises, the billboards. So I think everything that we see and perceive does something to our nervous system. So when we're in front of a canvas, or when I was in front of it, my nervous system was made up a certain way. So what I was putting out reflected what I was putting in. And I think it just naturally changed when we moved here. I am in my car maybe, well, especially now, maybe like once a week.
Oh, that's awesome.
I walk when I'm talking to you right now, looking out my window, and everything is green. Cat is sleeping right next to me. So everything is just more calm. And the palette is, it's not like I'm a site-specific painter, but I guess we all are in some sense, right? If we're taking in what's around us and putting it back out. So it was a really natural shift. It was not planned. It wasn't like, okay, we're in New Mexico now, new palette time.
Right.
It just, I remember actually mixing sort of an intense pink when we moved to Roswell, and just looking at the intensity of it on my palette and then looking outside, and it just was too much. Again, it didn't reflect the reality.
I think it's just an interesting lesson, though, for artists to just think about your environment and how much maybe it does affect you. And if it does seep into your art, you know, and what changes you could make, even small tweaks, like do you paint a lot of plants? Like, do you actually have plants within your environment that you're engaged? I don't know. I just think it's interesting to really think about, because we can't deny that our environment does influence our work.
Totally.
You know?
Totally. Yeah. And, yeah. And, but I think also there are artists who do the opposite, you know, if they're surrounded by, you know, some people might describe this palette as drab or boring, or, you know, so they might add intense colors just to sort of spice it up a bit or something, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, nothing lasts forever. I don't know if I'll be painting. I mean, my palette is already changing. The palette, of the works in my upcoming show at Hales, gallery in London, it's coming up in a month. It's already brighter than my last show at Conduit. So, you know, I think
we go through phases.
We do. Yeah. Exactly. It's just, yeah, it's like a type of food that you love for a while. And you're like, all right, enough oatmeal for breakfast. Let's have some eggs now.
Yes. Okay, Maya, I know that you, a big part of, you know, the storytelling that you paint about, and just a big part of your story, is the fact that you immigrated to the U.S. When you were 12, something like that.
12,
because of the Bosnian War. I was wondering if you, you know, we're just willing to share just a little bit about that experience in your life and how it has sort of, you know, manifested itself within your work.
Yeah. Yeah. I've talked a lot about, you know, sort of my family history of leaving the the war in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I would say it's definitely affected, you know, probably the themes of my work a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, my work deals a lot with intergenerational trauma and memory. But, you know, over time, as I've been talking to my mom and family members, I'm realizing that so much of the trauma that I'm actually interested in is maybe not as much about the social or the larger political event of a war, but more about family, like smaller domestic traumas. Hmm. And I guess what I mean by that, I just recently talked to my mom and she was telling me about how tough of a life my grandmother had, you know, my grandmother who passed away 3 years ago. Like I always knew that my family lineage was like, we came from a lot of poverty, mm-hmm. but I just never really realized that my grandma was, they were so poor mm-hmm. to the point where my mom, when my mom was born, they were homeless and that they didn't, they were staying at people's houses for the first couple of weeks of my mom's life. And I mean, there's more that I can get into, that I won't at this point, but
yeah.
So, like that's almost more interesting to me than just talking about a war that happened, which has obviously impacted my entire life trajectory and why I'm even here. You know, if there was no war, I probably would still be in Bosnia and who knows if I would be an artist.
Yeah.
Probably not because the resources are not there. But I think maybe what would always be there is this sort of family history of like poverty and trauma and pain that I really feel in my in the people, in the members of my family. Mm. So I think that's maybe one thing that I would like to sort of focus on as I continue to grow as an artist and as I continue talking to people is that sometimes when we talk about political issues and larger social things like a war, we sort of bypass the more the micro mm-hmm. Elements that are maybe even more painful somehow, mm-hmm. you know, like the father who becomes an addict because of a war or the mother who has PTSD that has never been treated and she's now raising her two kids, you mm-hmm. know, with treated PTSD. So that to me is more A, honest to me telling a story and being an artist, and B is like, it's the only thing that I guess I know about. I don't really know about the political implications about, I mean, other than what I've read and what I've been told by adults, because I was a kid when the war started there, right. You know, but it somehow doesn't touch me, doesn't touch my body the way that my alcoholic uncle or aunt would.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And you know, I mean, you could Google facts about the war and, you know, events and things. And it's not to say that that wouldn't be interesting for you to use as material for your painting. But, you know, like you were saying before, like so much of your work is about, you know, your own journey and the porous way that you're influenced by your senses and your environment and your emotions and your anxiety. And so right. definitely makes more sense for your work to be more directly related to your lineage. And my grandmother passed away this summer, and you know, just one of the things that I was recently telling a friend was just how I wish I had like asked her more about her life, you know, mm-hmm. and how when you're a child and you have a grandparent, I think it's really easy to be so like focused on yourself, and, you know, assume that the grandparent is just there for, you know, to provide you with things. And so yeah. I don't know, it's just interesting to think about your work and the way that maternal lineage is so like intertwined into, you know, your work. And I think you've always painted like maternal figures even before you had your daughter. And
Yeah. My father was absent when I was growing up. My parents separated. So I was raised by my mom and my aunt and my grandma. And my grandpa was really the only male figure who I love. Mm. He's still with us.
It seems like you often have three female figures in your work. Do you feel like that is representative of your mom, aunt, and grandma?
I wonder, you know, yeah. like it might be.
Yeah.
It's also something about the, you know, the Trinity,
right.
the triangular shape that maybe I intuitively just like the composition of, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep.
Who knows, you know, I feel really fortunate that I have a lot of really smart friends. A good friend of ours, Jason Laman Goldstein, he's an incredible art historian and artist. He made this beautiful sculpture for Mila that he just sent to us. It's stunning. But anyways, he'll often, when I post something on Instagram, he'll send me a historical connection to what I just shared.
And you're like, thanks.
yeah. Like, so, and I have other friends who do similar things where I call it like retroactive research. Yeah. You know, it's like research after the piece is done where I get help from even my husband will sometimes be like, Maya, that, like I made a painting, I guess 2 years ago now called Five Women. And, Josh was like, this is totally about or connected to Picasso's Mademoiselles de Avignon, you know?
Yeah.
So then I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, the composition, the number of women, there's this like one younger looking kind of masked figure in the front. So
that has to feel pretty good.
It feels good.
Yeah.
And it feels also kind of like you think you're that original and you realize that you're not.
Yes, that too.
Whether you're aware of it or not, you've soaked it all up. Like yeah. art history, like certain images are so iconic that they just etch themselves into your mind and you end up pulling from that sort of scene pot.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast. I wanted to drop in and share a bit more about our community and the many ways you can get involved. We post daily on Instagram at Artist Mother Podcast, sharing work from artists in our community and photos from our interviewed guests, plus inspiring takeovers and lots more. Use our hashtag ArtistMotherCo so we can find your work and see this community continue to expand. We have other more tangible ways for you to connect too. Our Crit Group program offers space for you to partner with a mentor and a small group of women artists to receive feedback on your work and get lots of support. We have yearly retreats for more intentional time spent in community. Picture a long weekend away with artist mama friends, taking in scenic nature and rest, learning opportunities like workshops, and of course, lots of time to talk. We're also always scheming ways for you to share your work outside of our community, and we have put together exhibitions for you multiple times a year. We believe in your work so much, and we want you to feel as supported as possible. Check out our offerings on our website at artistmotherpodcast.com. We even have t-shirts available in our webshop so you can represent our community. And if you appreciate what we're doing here, we would love to hear from you. iTunes reviews are greatly appreciated and help others hear about us. Thank you so much for listening, for connecting, and working together with us to create a beautiful network of artists and mothers. Okay, I want to hear you talk about being a mom. You know, are you willing to share a little bit about maybe what pregnancy was like for you and how your art practice maybe shifted during pregnancy? And well, let's just start there.
Sure. Yeah, it's a big question.
Yeah.
So, oh boy. So when I found out I was pregnant, we were just so excited and we felt really lucky because, we decided to get pregnant and it happened, you know, it wasn't a lot of work and I have a lot of friends who've been trying for a long time. So we felt really fortunate and lucky there. And there was just like, after that, like a series of crazy events. The very same day we were on our way to San Francisco, where I was doing a fundraiser art show, we get into this crazy car accident that totaled our car. But we were okay, fortunately, you know?
Yeah.
And then during the pregnancy, I found out I had gestational diabetes, which made it really hard to enjoy all the things I was looking forward to enjoying, like cookies and, you know, and ice cream. So I had to just all of a sudden start watching my diet like crazy. And I started Like I had to be more healthy than I think I ever was, because I had to check my blood 3 times a day or 2 hours after every meal. So
that's kind of a bummer.
It's crazy. I'm just like, are you kidding me? So that after I gave birth to Mila, I lost 30 pounds of just like water weight in 2 days.
Oh my gosh.
And then I was like, just like 10 pounds. The whole thing was just like crazy.
Isn't it crazy?
It's just, I never thought it would be. And I also know it's not the same for every woman. Like I have a friend, Tammy, who I walked with. I had to do my glucose walks every morning for an hour, you know, and we would talk about it. And she was like, oh man, Maya, you seem like you got the shit cards, you know,
yeah. For,
you know, but, anyways, Mila was she was born healthy. Thank goodness. But I ended up having this really rare, syndrome called HELLP syndrome, HELLP, which stands for hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, low platelet count.
Oh gosh.
And basically hemolysis, I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. It's the rupturing of red blood cells. So this happened at exactly 39 weeks, which means she was full term.
Oh, wow.
And it happened while I was having contractions. So I thought I would just be having, like, my goal was to have a nice natural birth. And I was like, okay, I think she's maybe going to be here in a day or two because my contractions were really spaced out. And then all of a sudden I got this really intense spasm on the when she was 39 weeks, and I knew something was wrong. So Josh rushed me to the hospital, which is only like 3 minutes away from us, luckily. And, they were like, oh my God, your liver is failing. We need to get the shit out. We need to do a C-section now. So from the time I arrived to the hospital and Mila's birth, like the whole thing lasted maybe 2 hours.
Wow. Is this because of the gestational diabetes?
So it could be. Huh. Not necessarily, because they were monitoring my blood pressure and all my vitals up to 2 days before this happened. So just 2 days before it happened, I went and I had my checkup and my blood pressure was perfect. And one of the main ways they can tell that HELLP is, which is such a funny acronym, right?
Right.
That HELLP is on its way is like by blood pressure rising. But I had like 120 over 80. I was walking. I felt great. They did blood tests. Everything was looking beautiful. I was dilating. My cervix was thinning. They were just like, you're going to have a beautiful birth.
Oh.
So they were just,
bummer.
It just came on really suddenly. But I just feel so lucky that Mila was full term, because yeah, it can happen earlier. And in every case, the only way to help the mom is to get the baby out.
Mm.
So I was just thinking, like, my God, if she was like 20 weeks.
Right.
Oh,
I'm so glad to hear that. You know, it happened when it did, but also, you know, that you're okay. I'm assuming recovery was hard, but you're good now.
I'm good now. Yeah. But it was, to be totally honest, quite traumatic. And I was dealing with depression, postpartum depression for, mm-hmm, I would say probably the first month. I was in a really dark place, mainly feeling like my body was giving up, you know, mm-hmm, and I was at that point still taking a lot of meds and I was in a lot of pain. But fast forward to now, I'm doing a lot better.
Good.
And we're getting sleep. Mila's only waking up 2 times a night.
Hey, which that's good.
I feel like that's pretty good. And Josh and I alternate. I pump a bottle. So he gives it the first time she wakes up, he gives it to her. And then I wake up later. So I actually, we each get like a good 4 to 5 hour stretch at night.
That's great.
So, yeah. And then in terms of how has this impacted my art? Oh my God.
Have you started making yet again, or have you just kind of taken a break?
You know, I thought I would not do anything for 3 months.
Yeah.
But during this kind of postpartum depression phase, she was napping a lot during the first month. I just needed to do something. So I started drawing obsessively.
Mm.
And I actually have an upcoming something that I can't talk about right now with the speaking. But it became a perfect way, like it was both simultaneously an outlet for what was going on with me. And at the same time, I got this opportunity for the work to be displayed, for the drawings to be displayed.
Oh, great.
So
what are the materials you're drawing with?
So I'm only using these Micron pens. They're like illustration pens with Tyvol black ink and just Sumi ink.
Nice.
So, and I go into the studio, I try to go, but you know, to be totally honest, Josh and I try to do this thing where we each get like an hour or two a day. And I'm realizing that, it's almost more stressful to get an hour than to get no time at all.
Yeah.
Because I'll get started on something and then, you know, I breastfeed, then I have to come in and then I forgot to clean the brushes and then the brushes are ruined. And then I get all frustrated. And then I realized, okay, I need to do things that are immediate. Mm-hmm. Like drawings are, from the moment I sit down, I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear her crying, I stop. Nothing needs to be cleaned up. So I'm really thinking about immediacy and what's actually really vital. So there's zero wasted time these days.
I don't think I've ever interviewed an artist where the materials that they use did not change, like, you know, kind of immediately after having a baby, because, you know, for whatever reason, like we can't do that big 4, 5, 6, 7 hour studio stretch and the material, you know, the luxury of using these materials that need that amount of time. It's just not possible. Like you said, you have to break up your practice into shorter increments and, you know, it's either death to your art or you adapt, you know?
Yeah. And I really am welcoming the change. And also I feel that maybe when I'm not exclusively breastfeeding and when she's a little bit older, there'll be some flexibility there, you know, when we can give her a bottle or some food. But for right now, my boobs and Mila are best friends. BFFs. And until then, I think, I cannot be best friends with my paintings. I can just be kind of friends with painting.
Are you feeling okay about that? Like, is it hard or, you know, is it just kind of, you feel like you've accepted it and it is what it is?
You know, I'm going to be totally honest because I think, maybe people need to be honest in these things. I wish I could say that, oh, I've totally surrendered to putting my art on a back burner and just completely relishing and being a mom, but it would be a lie, you know? It wasn't until I had Mila that I realized that for me, making art is so much more than having a career. And I realized for me, it's my spiritual practice. So Josh and I would always, or I would say jokingly, you know, like going to the studio is like my church, but, I really understand that now. And it really is. So part of me being a good mom is making art.
Yes.
Like they're not one or the other. And, how does it feel when I only get 2 hours in there? Painful.
Yeah.
I have cried over it. You know, when I'm working on an area and such a huge part of my practice is looking at a stain for hours. And I realize a luxury of my practice was going back into my house, making a cup of coffee and just staring at a section for an hour and then leaving and then knowing what to do the next day. So to not have that time to where I can just like doze off and stare, that felt like, I used to think it was just procrastinating. And now I'm like, no, I was never procrastinating. Mm-hmm. I was painting without actually making marks by deep looking. And I miss that so much right now. And I know that as Mila gets older, I'll get more of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, for me, art, I now fully understand. And I think Mila is the gift for it's a spiritual practice. I feel lucky that it's both a career and a spiritual endeavor. And it makes it difficult feeling like I can't go to my version of church as often as I want to. But, I found drawing to, satisfy a craving or a need that, is good enough for now that I know wouldn't be forever, but it's kind of a, momentary satiation.
And that like exactly what you're saying is why I have this podcast, right? Like why I want to talk about this with people, because I find so much truth in what you shared, and too that we, you know, it's like almost like we don't even really know our own identity until it's taken away from us, or like until we have to sacrifice parts of our identity for something else. And, you know, then you really know, like you really know who you are and what you care about when you can't have that thing. And I think that's, you know, just the mind-boggling part about being a mom too, is that it's like you are eager, you're enjoying this part of your identity, but then it comes with losing yourself, you know? It's so hard.
Totally. Well, I think I've always thought of the word like multitude when I think about what I want the paintings to contain and how I thought of myself, and I'm really having to live it now, like a multitude of identities. Like,
is that a Walt Whitman quote? I am large, I contain multitudes.
Oh, I think that sounds about right.
Yeah. Is it what Whitman? I'll have to look it up. But there's a piece of poetry that talks about that I have had on my studio wall for so long. Like just this idea of, you know, we don't have to be this singular thing, you know?
We don't. And actually, you know, when I talk to women who are really depressed, who said, you know, after I had my kid, I just didn't pick up a brush for a year. And I just know I can't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, to be the best mom for Mila, I have to pick up a brush. You know what I mean? So it's almost like Josh and I, we're both painters, and we're going to come up with a way in which we can do that, where we both need to be in the studios. And I think with creativity, we'll come up with a way that that's possible. You know, yeah. I refuse to think that you're either a mom or a painter. You know, I really want to live both.
Okay, so just a couple more questions. I'm, you know, because we're still in crazy global pandemic, you know, just wanting to hear you talk a little bit about how the pandemic, like, did it affect any shows that you were going to have, or, you know, just the practical day-to-day of your life? I'm sure you're probably a little bit glad you're in New Mexico rather than LA. Just if you could talk a little bit about that, how it's affected your and your partner's life.
So mainly, so my show at Hales that's opening in on September 10th was originally supposed to open in May. So that obviously was postponed for a long time. We didn't even know when the new date would be. So that show has been affected, and you know, now it will be open, I believe, by appointment only, and we won't be able to travel for it. So it's my first London show that I'll miss, which is really, really sad.
That's a bummer.
But, you know, considering the state of the world, it'll be worse, you know?
Yep.
And then my show at Conduit that opened in February was affected. The tail end of it was, I think, the last 2 weeks. The gallery had to close and do it because it was in March. It was right at the beginning of the pandemic. So luckily I had an opening. I think it was on February 29th. So it was really well attended. So, but then it just had to be closed early, or not early, but you know, people couldn't just come in whenever they wanted.
Right.
And then in terms of our day-to-day, to be totally honest, we live in such a remote part of New Mexico that it hasn't really changed. We have studios that are connected to our house. So
is your partner an artist too, I'm guessing?
Yeah. So okay. Josh Miller is his name, and he's a painter as well. He's a really good painter. Okay. And he's actually the reason why we ended up in Roswell. So there's a Roswell Artists in Residence program, which is a really competitive residency. And Josh ended up getting it in 2018.
Okay.
We both moved out here for that from LA, and they were so kind to me, and they gave me a studio as well.
Oh, that's great.
It was the first time I got, like I actually had a really big studio. And that had a lot to do with why my work got bigger when we moved.
And you just liked it so much that you decided to stay? Or is he still a resident?
Yeah, no. So the residency is only a year.
Okay.
And we were loving it so much here. The sort of the landscape and our art was really thriving because of it. We found out about the sort of alumni housing, which used to be the original residency. So we were lucky enough that they had an open house and open studios for us. So we basically just moved a mile down the road where it is no longer the residency, but former residents live here.
Wow. That's
and
great.
And there are artists who have been here since the 90s, you know, older artists. So it's a really nice community.
And still you feel like you have, you know, art connection, even though you're kind of more remote and certainly very far from large cities.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, like, Josh and I both have a gallery in London, and I have a gallery in New York and Dallas. So I feel connected to the art world very much so still. And maybe this is how I would want it for the rest of my life, to be away from the big cities, but be able to go whenever I do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see, you know, things change, but, you know, sometimes, I don't know, we find what we want and that's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, Maya. So I always close with five questions. And I recently switched these up because I had done, I don't know, 70 interviews with these other questions. And I'm like, I think it's time to change these. So I'm excited to hear your answers. Curious to know, who is your biggest art crush?
Oh my gosh, my biggest art crush. Do they have to be dead or alive?
Anybody. You can name a few if you want to.
Yes. I'm probably boring to people right now, but my ultimate sort of art crush is Mark Rothko.
Oh, nice.
His paintings have changed me in ways every time I've stood in front of them, in ways I've talked about in other, Mila made appearance.
She has something to say.
She does. Yeah. She's quite the chugger. Mm. So I would say Rothko is sort of as historical, has affected me. Like, his work has made me cry for the first time on that level, that kind of sensorial thing we talked about.
Yes.
His red paintings at the Tate in London have made me feel things I didn't even know a person is capable of feeling name, you know, to bring up this no word sublime that he was chasing after, you know, or that he was, I really felt that in that room. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it felt both like I was dying and I was entering a new sphere. It was so incredible.
I can't wait to go now.
it's my favorite art experience I think I've ever had. Favorite is not even the right word. Something deeper, I think. And then living artists that I really love. There's an artist at Karma shows that I just think is beautiful. Andrew Cranston.
Okay.
I really love his work. Gosh.
I'll have to look it up. Is he a painter?
Yeah, he's a painter. Yeah, I think he lives somewhere in Europe, I believe.
Okay.
So many others. Like, I love Amy Sillman, Philip Guston. Kathy Wilkes is somebody I adore, who's not a painter. Mm-hmm. She's an installation artist and a sculptor. She's Irish, but I believe lives in England. We saw her work for the first time at the 2013 Venice Biennale. She represented Ireland. And I think this last time she represented England. I highly recommend looking up her work. Kathy with a C.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, what is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
Gosh, we've been dreaming about trips so much these days.
Yeah, right?
Yep. Yeah. I would love to go somewhere. I just really crave a beautiful ocean, somewhere like in Croatia or Greece. I think, yeah, somewhere in Europe with a beautiful water view of the ocean or water. And I just can't wait to have like a glass of wine.
Yes. Just sit at the ocean with some wine and a good sunset. Sounds pretty perfect.
Yeah. But in general, Josh and I really love spending time in Europe. And we really love going to Europe. A couple of years ago, we spent some time in, hold on one second. Maybe if you just sit down and if she starts crying, I'll hand her off to you again. Well, Josh and I did a residency in 2017 in Lyon.
Oh, nice. Not
Lyon. It's spelled Lehon. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful, tiny little town. And our studios were inside of a church. So wow. We would hear stories about our monks getting high on, or what were they drinking? I don't know, getting high. So we all loved, of course, being in there and making art. There were five of us total. So we'll sometimes, when we're having dinner here in Roswell, reminisce and say, oh, if we could just get back down, you know, to do my runs in the morning, right along this little creek. Yeah. And it was just so idyllic, you know, like I want to put on my running shoes and just like run 8 miles and come back and start a new painting, like to feel powerful and strong.
Yes.
And go enjoy like beautiful galettes and spend hours talking about philosophy and art with our neighbors.
Ugh, when can we live in that world again?
I know. I believe we can. We will get there.
But this time you'll have a beautiful daughter to enjoy it with. So, you know.
And she's growing by the second, it seems like.
Yes.
So pretty happy and having her own opinions.
Okay. What film or book has inspired you greatly?
Ah, book. Well, funny you should ask. I just started reading Martin Buber, I and Thou, who I was introduced to through Josh, actually. So I was reading this book called The Matrixial Border Space a couple of years ago, written by a psychoanalyst, philosopher, artist, Braca Ettinger, and she mentioned Buber a lot in her book. So she's talking about identity in a really interesting way that's sort of beyond, in my opinion, beyond feminist or this kind of binary male-female. And so she would mention Buber a lot when she was talking about these existential ideas about our sense of I and our relation to the beings around us and the world. So I just started it. I can't really say I'm an expert, but yeah. It's already had a profound effect on me. Mm. And I recently finished Ocean Vuong's On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, which I know is really well read and everyone knows about it, but that was incredible and powerful. And I finished it right before Mila was born.
So I almost got that at the library yesterday. I got Margaret Atwood's new book instead, but The Testament. Oh.
Yeah, I've heard of that one. Have you started it?
I haven't started it yet. Nope.
Okay.
But I'm glad to know the On Earth We Are Briefly Gorgeous comes recommended by you. I'll have to get that next.
It's really, really incredible. Ocean Vuong. Yeah, Josh and I kind of binged on him for a while, like listening to YouTube interviews and listening to him read poetry. His book of poetry, Josh was reading at the same time that I was reading On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, called Exit Wounds, I believe.
I'll just check that out.
And then movie. God, since we've had Mila, I haven't really been able to fully pay attention to a movie. But let me think, what was the last one that we watched? I'm drawing a blank on this. And I know we watch a lot of movies. I think my brain is just fried right now.
It's okay if you can't come up with one.
Movie household.
Okay. What is your favorite meal?
My favorite meal. Oh gosh. Well, the vegetarians and vegans are not going to like this answer, but when Josh and I first started dating, he was like, what do you want to do for Valentine's Day? And I was like, just make me a nice piece of steak and some kale.
Some meat.
I forget. It was some kind of green leaf vegetable. Asparagus.
Oh, maybe. Asparagus. Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel guilty saying this.
That's
but,
okay.
It's my favorite meal. I really do love steak and just like a simple green vegetable and a really nice glass of wine.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, probably a lot of people's favorite meal.
Yeah.
I know it's my sister's. I'm a vegetarian, but my sister is not. And that's hands down her favorite meal is asparagus and steak.
So. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
That's
maybe
funny.
It's a blood type thing. I remember being really into this blood type diet and I'm O positive. And I guess according to my mom, we're like the meat eaters.
Who knew?
The Neanderthals.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, last question. And I know this one is a really hard question for people to answer because there's, I'm sure, so many people who have supported you and your work and, you know, who you would want to give a shout out to. But is there, you know, someone in particular that you feel like you should just say a quick thank you to or a shout out for supporting you in your work?
Yes, they come to mind. There's, I think, four people I want to give a shout out to. And the first two, they're collectors of mine who I get teary-eyed thinking about who I would not have been able to make work if it wasn't for them.
Mm.
And Dan McNevin and Megan Campbell. They're both San Francisco-based collectors who are buying my work long before anyone was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was when my work was in the hundreds and it would literally be how I would pay my rent and buy my groceries. So both of them, I want to say thanks to. And then Dan McNevin in particular, he was kind of a patron in many ways. When I didn't have any money to pay rent or when Josh and I wanted to do this traveling project, I would sometimes just say, hey, what do you think about, I'm going to make 10 paintings. What do you think about paying up front for the five of them or something, you know, and if you could just give me the money in advance, I'll give you a good deal or something, you know,
mm-hmm.
You would always support me.
Mm.
So, like I really, and this is when I had like multiple jobs. At one point in San Francisco, I had five jobs and I was totally going crazy. Anyway, so Dan and Megan, they were kind of the glue that kept me in the studio. Because I would sometimes sell something for like 1,000 or two, or maybe at one point, like even 10,000 when I was like totally broke, you know, living
yeah.
on rice and beans. So when those things happened, I would go and buy materials and, or I would be able to pay for 5 months of rent or something. So those two people in terms of like, monetary support for sure. And then the two people who've been like my number one fans, I would say is my mom. She is like my toughest critic, but also so engaged and committed to supporting me as an artist. And she too would help me with money, like by sending me money for canvas and when she herself was financially struggling. So I just think that's so rare to find a parent who A, wants their child to be an artist, but B, like an immigrant parent who's already struggling. And then the last person I just want to say thanks to would be my husband, Josh.
Who's sitting right here so you can do this interview.
He was, yeah.
That's yeah, great.
Emotional thinking about it. But when, you know, I didn't even think the work was that good or, yeah.
I love that, Maya. I think you're going to make me cry. having a partner who understands and is supportive is life-changing for an artist.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how else you could do it. You couldn't do this alone, I think.
Yeah.
So I think also, like, I think artists, like, we're both powerful and also, like, really fragile.
Yes, we are. And mothers, too. Mothers are so powerful and can be broken so easily, you know?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I mean, it's hilarious how many emotions go through our household these days, especially
yes.
here. It's like love, complete defeat, complete destruction.
Yes.
Sorry.
No, thank you so much. It's so refreshing to hear, you know, your passion and your vulnerability. I'm so, so, so grateful for you sharing and spending time in conversation with me today, Maya. Thank you so much.
So much, Kaylin. I really enjoyed our interview. And yeah, I don't think I've ever done an interview where I've been so sleep deprived.
We'll blame it on that.
Yeah, and maybe the two go so hand in hand, you know, sometimes. Yes. Don't they, like, sleep deprive people to torture them and to have them tell secrets?
Yep, pretty sure. So you blame your daughter, not me, but I'm grateful that I'm the one who got to talk to you, because this was truly inspiring. The last thing I like to do is just ask you where people can find you. Where do you like people to follow you and be connected to your work?
Yeah, I'd probably say the best way to follow what I'm up to is on Instagram. And my handle is Maya Ruz, MajaRuz.
Okay.
I don't really update my website that consistently anymore. But I also have works that are available and that are to be seen at the galleries that I work with, which you mentioned. And they're with Conduit in Dallas, Hales Gallery in London and New York, and then Karma in New York.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kaylin. I really enjoyed talking to you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.